Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Under a Shady Tree with Reverend Terry Power and Robin McKean. Come on in. Grab a glass of sweet iced tea and sit right down. These two mountain witches are about to start their talk.
Reverend Terry Power, and you are under a shady tree with Terry and Robin. That's right. I am joined, as most nights, by my lady, my love, my best friend, my partner, my wife. Hey, Robin.
Hi, honey.
How you doing, darling?
I'm doing pretty good. I just found out that we have yet some more duties during Ishtar. Did you get that?
Yeah, I just saw that. We're participating in the main ritual, I guess, so.
It looks like we are priest and priestess.
Well, you know, I've got to look through that because I've got to look through that. But it looks like it's going to be an interesting ritual. So
it does.
And honored to be asked and to be a part of it. So
absolutely.
I'm
a little bit surprised, that's all.
Me too. I got the email, and, you know, we had both said, you know, we'll do whoever you need to help. You know, that's just who we are.
Yeah.
I didn't expect so much. You know, such a, you know, significant role, I guess, let's put it that way. So, you know, honored and thrilled to be a part of it. So, I honored and thrilled to be a part of Ishtar Fest at all. It's going to be a hoot. It's just going to be a great time. So, we'll talk more about that. We'll more about that toward the end of the show. So, everybody want to stay tuned in. We'll be talking about Ishtar Fest Sumer Fair toward the end of the program tonight.
Okay.
The topic tonight, these are the Thursday nights that are set aside for Robin and I to kind of ramble, maybe, or talk about something that we have encountered or experienced that we want to share with people. And tonight is one of those nights. We watched on Netflix, actually, this past weekend, we watched a three-part docuseries discussing the relationship between animal and plant kingdoms and rethinking the history of all life on this globe.
Yeah.
And we were both moved and affected by this information, and we've talked probably just about every day since then. We have had some brief conversation about it, some new realization. And I suspect that the concepts will continue to evolve and percolate in our minds and in our conversations for some time to come. And this is exactly the kind of topic that we set aside one night a month for discussion and for sharing. And
ramblings.
Yeah. And ramblings, perhaps, that's okay too. The gist of it is that plant life kind of guided the evolution of animal life. And it raises questions about who is serving whom in this relationship. And there's certainly a, definitely a coexistence, a symbiosis. That's the word I was looking for. Where plants need the carbon dioxide that animals exhale, and animals need the oxygen that plants exhale, essentially. And go ahead.
I was going to say, the thing that struck me, because it was such a different way of looking at it, and it truly is the truth, is that trees and plants, their waste product is oxygen, because that's what they give off after they've taken in the carbon dioxide that feeds them. So they eat the carbon dioxide, and then their waste product is oxygen. So when you start thinking about it from that perspective, it creates a very different spin on the whole relationship between plants and everything else on the planet. The interesting thing was that, all these millions of years ago, you and I were talking about this, plants did not have leaves. And then there came a time where there were so many plants on the planet that there was a lack of carbon dioxide for them to eat. There was too much oxygen in the atmosphere for them. So in order to more effectively process the carbon dioxide that was in the atmosphere, they developed leaves. And they showed a close-up of the leaves, and it was like hundreds of little teeny mouths sucking in carbon dioxide, like little gills all over the leaves. It was just fascinating. And that was around, it was later after that, that insects and things started to occur. So, did the propagation of leaves, or the mutation that created the leaves, give rise to the bugs and things and other life forms on the planet? And how did that happen? I mean, that's really part of the most interesting part of this is, did the plants have a hand in our creation in one way or another, so that we could then come along ultimately, up the food chain, so that we could come along and breathe out carbon dioxide, which is what they need to live? And we've always thought of it as, the trees provide us with oxygen to breathe. Well, no, that's not necessarily true, because they were the first organisms on the planet. They are the ultimate native indigenous peoples, if you will, on the planet, plants. And we came along a whole heck of a lot later. So it would stand to reason, if you look at that logically, that it's not them that's there to benefit us, that technically we are here to benefit them by breathing out carbon dioxide, which is what they need to survive.
Yeah, so...
almost,
you know,
maybe keep cattle ourselves.
Did they guide the creation of animals and the
mm-hmm.
mutation of animals
mm-hmm.
through mutation of the plants to satisfy their need?
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a tremendous amount of demonstration of, if not intelligence in the traditional concept of self-awareness, that we usually attribute to, higher life forms.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, an ability to communicate through chemical signals. It's very fascinating. Let me jump in with one more thing, and
mm-hmm.
then I'm going to get out of the way and let you ramble because you're much more eloquent at this. You've processed it further than I have. I'm still working on all of this. But
mm-hmm.
the part that fascinated me at the very beginning of that journey through those 3 hours of programming was the fact that the guy that wrote it was a geologist.
Right.
And that he had spent his life studying the changes on the Earth, looking at them from a geological point of view, that these,
mm-hmm.
Functions of the Earth and the planets and the planet and the rocks drove all of the changes of in life forms throughout, history. And it was his epiphany, if you will, of the fact that the animals were driven, that all of these changes, including certain geological changes on the planet, were caused by the plants, not by geology.
Uh-huh. Right.
And then he spent 3 hours sharing his epiphany with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the part that struck me, was here's this rock guy,
mm-hmm.
Coming to grips with the idea that plants
yep.
were the real changers and the real controllers, if
mm-hmm.
you will, of life and everything on this globe, including the color of the color of the water, the soil, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So now you had a bunch to say. I apologize. I wanted to throw that in there at the beginning.
That's okay.
So,
one of the fascinating things is how much a lot of what he talks about mimics a lot of the old legends and spirituality that have been handed down through time. For example, that trees have a type of awareness, that trees were the beginning of everything, the world tree, right? the tree of life. And so many cultures look at trees as having had a part in our origins and in our caretaking. One of the things that he talked about was how there was a time amongst plants where there was no such thing as grass. And grasses grew up out of an opportunistic moment in evolution, and they decided that they needed more space, because the grasses were originally growing in these little, filtered down spots of light in the forest, and wasn't enough. And so they developed this grass that was extremely fat flammable. So it would rub its fronds together in a breeze and create a spark. And that was all it needed to ignite and create grass fires. And we still, to this day, have these types of grass fires. But what was ingenious about this is that the grass fires would burn the trees and kill the trees, but the grass would survive, thereby allowing the grass to spread. If that's not intelligence of a sort, a wanting to survive is one of the very first kindlings of intelligence, being aware that you need to continue as a species. So if that's not intelligence, I'd like to hear somebody talk to me about that. But so that, and he described it as a battle of the plants between the grass and the trees. So, and that these fires raged for years and years and years.
And that occurred rather late.
Yeah.
Comparatively speaking, in the geological sense of the age of the planet.
Right.
Because throughout the Jurassic periods, the Earth was a giant, all the land was basically a giant rainforest.
Right.
You know, it was a giant rainforest, and there was there were no polar ice caps.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, what is presumed to have been an extraterrestrial, asteroid of some sort, an astronomical or astrological event that caused a darkening of the skies,
mm-hmm.
which then caused the surviving plants to have a certain mutation that developed leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Because ferns, basically it was tall coniferous trees and ferns. And then the trees that had any kind of leaf and plants that had leaves grew up out of that cataclysm. And then, from there, flowers began to be introduced, and that gave rise to a symbiosis between certain insect species and pollinators. And then after that, you have fruit that
mm-hmm.
became the payoff for larger animals, because the mutation
and
that created nectar. Yeah, because,
mm-hmm.
The mutation of plants that caused nectar became the payoff for the pollinators
mm-hmm.
that would then spread, instead of just the seeds wherever they fell or were blown, or ferns had their pollen spread by water, and that was as far as they could spread, flowers and their insect allies allowed pollination to take place across vast areas, moving inland away from the waters.
Mm-hmm.
And bright colors and nectar were the payoff. Okay,
mm-hmm.
you come and pick up the pollen, and in exchange, I'm going to give you this sweet energy drink. And, it became this kind of guiding evolution. More
mm-hmm.
and more species began to develop these long snouts or long proboscis or a long tongue or hummingbirds with the long beaks. All of this was driven by that plant mutation.
Right.
And then as larger animals began to interact and get into the process, fruit became a mutation. The actual ovary of the plant grew into this meat surrounding the seeds, and now we can have our seed carried for kilometers, miles across to other continents, to other parts of this continent. Because now animals are eating these fruit and then traveling miles away, and their excrement contains the seed husks that then become new plants, and they're further spread across the plains or whatever. All of
Right.
this driven by plants mutating and guiding the development of animals. I find that part fascinating. Humbling in so many ways.
Yeah. One of the really interesting things he talked about, and you touched on ferns and how they propagate, is the fern actually creates something akin to a sperm, and the sperm drips into the river. And when the sperm drips into the river and it meets and it encounters in the water the female egg that the female ferns drop in the water as well, the first cell of the sperm goes into the egg and you know, has that spark, and it's going to become a plant. However, there's a second molecule in the sperm that also goes into the egg and creates a food source for
That was actually the rise of seeds. That only takes place in that evolutionary stage after flowers.
Right.
It wasn't the ferns. It was the flowers that have that second fertilization.
I thought he talked about that in relation to the fern. But anyway.
No, that was the seeds.
Maybe,
that was
right.
The seeds that come from the flowers. That was how that seed where the live plant, the
mm-hmm.
egg, is now surrounded by a food source, and it gives it the durability to lay dormant.
Right,
to lay dormant because it has that food source from the secondary fertilization, and that is fascinating. That is very, very cool. I remember we backed that up to show our little girl how cool this is, and that's how seeds.
Mm-hmm.
That's how seeds allowed flowering plants to spread beyond the waters.
Mm-hmm.
Because
ferns
were trapped at the water's edge.
And it was very interesting in that it was so similar to the way humans reproduce that it just kind of blew me away. That, I mean, I've always kind of known, you know, seeds, you know, and actually when I explained to my daughter how babies were born, I, you know, when she was 5 and she asked me and I said, you know, the daddy plants the seed in the mommy like we plant the seed in the garden, all of a sudden, like, I was like, wow, I don't know, you know, that was like more real than it may have seemed at the time I said it.
But it was enough for a 5-year-old. That was good.
Oh, yeah, I mean, and she still is living with that definition and hasn't asked me any more questions. So, but anyway, this program, you know, one of the things I started to, I went over to Owl's house tonight, to Jackie's house, and we were talking about this. And one of the things that we started to kick around was, you know, they've done this research, and this was a separate issue, where, you know, people go into the forests and they've documented the trees creating sort of chemical pheromones and things that feel better if we're feeling stressed out or whatever. Things that we, you know, take in as we're walking through the woods. The trees are trying to take care of us. So what does that say about how the trees see us? Do the trees see us as sort of, like, again, like I'm going back to like almost like a livestock where they're trying to take care of us because they need us to breathe out the carbon dioxide to help them survive. So it behooves them to take care of us and make sure that we're in good health. And also, the converse could be true, that perhaps when the trees start to feel crowded and threatened, is it possible that they could create a kind of chemical warfare against us as well, subtle warfare? Could they mutate viruses? Could they, mutate bacteria to affect us? And that brings us to a whole other level again of how intelligent are they? Is this something that's feasibly possible?
Yeah. Well, how much did the rise of you know, our understanding of medicinal herbs, the mutations that caused mm-hmm. all these different plants that have all of these beneficial qualities.
Exactly.
To
Jackie
human,
and I,
Is that driven by a desire to care for the carbon uh-huh. dioxide producing creatures that share yeah. the planet and give them CO2 to, uh-huh. to breathe and
right.
do their chemical stuff?
Exactly. Jackie and I said that too. I mean, and it's funny that you went to the same place that we did. So
why is that funny?
You know,
what's so surprising about that? You say that like
well,
it's a big surprise.
No, it's just interesting that we both were struck by that independently.
Interesting.
But, you know, and it really starts to raise questions about our existence and about how we view plants. And if I were a vegetarian, and I'm not, but if I were a vegetarian right about now, I'd have to be rethinking how I felt about plants. Because if this were true, then actually the mammals and the animals on this planet were created by the plants to keep them alive, which means that
we should be moral carnivores.
Well, yeah, but as the perspective would change then, that the plants are really the more important thing to maintain the planet and our health than the animals, because the animals are just here to, exhale
make more
carbon
dioxide.
Exactly.
So the moral vegetarians should now be moral carnivores because the plants are
a higher
created animal to be food. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That could like rock people's worlds.
there you go.
Yeah. I'm a true believer, in moderation.
Yeah, but it reinforces my belief in the consumption of animal flesh. So it just, you know, that helps. It's all good.
It's just
right.
a very interesting.
The whole thing is fascinating. That's why we're talking about it tonight. We are at 27 minutes after the top of the hour and hurtling rapidly toward break time. And I have gone through all of our list of songs, and I have found a song by Jenna Green called Soul of Nature. And it seems somewhat appropriate to our conversation tonight. So let's go ahead and listen to take a break. Everybody, you know, relax. And we're going to listen to Jenna Green sing Soul of Nature. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. Stick around, everybody.
I love your beauty.
Message from our friends over at International Pagan Radio.
Tune in to International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net, or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter, too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
You're listening to Terry and Robin on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We're glad you're here. Now, back to the show.
We'll move your Virginia.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Reverend Terry Power, and you are under a shady tree with Terry and Robin. How you doing over there, Robin?
I'm doing pretty good.
All right. I think it's interesting that we're talking about plants and our show tonight is under a shady tree. So.
Mm-hmm.
I do love Jenna Green's voice. What a beautiful song. So.
Very true.
Hope everybody enjoyed that and welcome back to our discussion of the relationship and our rethinking of a relationship between the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom, and who's actually driving this boat. You know, there's certainly a human-centric thought process that has, you know, guided much of, you know, much of the you know, written history of this, you know, of our existence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this idea that we are the pinnacle.
Mm-hmm.
And in so many ways we may be, and that we are the first species on this planet that's capable of actually just messing up the planet so bad that we can't live here.
Yeah.
Yay us. Yeah, yay us. But, yeah, you know, that's our claim to fame. We are actually the first species that has capability to make this planet uninhabitable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something to be said for humans. But, you know, the relationship between plants and animals, the way that it can be demonstrated that plant mutations, whether conscious or unconscious, that's another philosophical discussion for another time. We're simply planting the seeds of thought. Get it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, plants planting the seeds.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so we're just simply giving you food for thought. And each person is going to have to find their own answers. But, you know, were those mutations conscious or not or random? You know, every few generations, there's going to be a mutation, and if that mutation is beneficial, it's going to stick around. You know, the same with animal life responding to these mutations.
Mm-hmm.
If you see conscious design, then you're going to see this as driving the creation of certain species of animals. if you tend toward the idea that it's all just completely random and we're along for the ride, well, then you're probably not listening to our shows anyway. But, you know, I just don't think we got a lot of atheists in the audience. But you know, however you think about this, the idea has always been that this stuff was kind of random and that really there wasn't much interaction from the, you know, spiritual aspects of things until after humans, and we're the only ones that are capable of spirituality because, you know, we can, you know, tear shit up. But you know, this forces the question of the spirit, the consciousness of creation itself, and how that guided, through plant mutation, the development of animal life and the species that we know today, and the traits that we know today. One of the things that fascinated me is that prior to a mutation in primates, it is believed that all animals were colorblind and could not see red. But without being able to see the ripening of the fruit, and fruit basically turns red when it's ripe as a signal, hi, I'm ready to eat, don't eat me before now. You know, it's just a lump hanging up there. Now it's red. It's good to eat. Now you can spread the seeds. Because the seeds aren't even ready to be spread. They're not mature until the plant turns red. So that signal by the plants turning red also triggered a mutation in primates that could then see red. Oh, that fruit is better. It's sweeter now. And this is better to eat, and the plants controlled the animals eating the immature seeds and spreading seeds that weren't ready. So, I mean, without those two mutations, the fruit would not be, you know, eaten after it was ripe. And, of course, animals would be eating, you know, sour, not ready fruit, or would never touch them anyway because, damn, I'm not eating that. So those two mutations, the fruit gets sweet and turns red. Hi, I'm ready. Eat me and spread the seeds. And animals being able to see that color. Again, all of it seems to one drives the other. And plant mutations come first. Even the mutation in grass. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, we were talking a little earlier about the pollinators, and one of the things I found really fascinating was, and I had heard this just recently on a show about bees, where, you know, we've all watched bees working a flower bush, and I've often wondered, how do the bees know which flowers have pollen in them and don't, So basically what happens is the bee goes to a flower. The flower emits a vibration, a tone, if you will. Once the bee takes the pollen from the flower changes its tone that it emits, that it's sending out. And the bee knows that's not the right tone for this flower. There's no pollen in there. I'll move to another flower. When that flower has more pollen, its tone goes back to the original tone to tell the bee that it has flower, that it has pollen in the flower. And then there's a bee that they showed this that has a specific adaptation for one particular flower that when it approaches a flower and lands on the flower, in order for the flower to give up its pollen, the bee has to change the vibration of its wings very consciously to get the flower to, it literally shoots the pollen out onto the bee once the bee changes the way the vibration of its wings, the hum that it's giving off, if you will.
It's just actually a musical note. And it's music.
So this was, and this was a way that the flower could ensure that the bee was going to take its pollen, the right bee was going to take its pollen.
And that the bee was going to be trained to go to the right kind of flower to pollinate the right kind of flower, not just spread the pollen around randomly.
Right, to other flowers that it couldn't, you know, the pollen wasn't compatible with.
Exactly. So it gave this reward for this behavior, and then only that type of flower gave that reward, so that bee concentrates on that flower, that type of flower, and therefore propagates just that species of flower. So they're locked into this symbiotic microcosm of life, and then other plants develop relationships with other insects. So it is fascinating, and food for tons more thought, and and we will probably watch that again to pick up additional information we missed the first time through, because that is the way with all good learning material, is that you only get part of it the first time through. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the rise of cities, the rise of human civilization is once again this great leap in evolution, this great leap in development comes from a plant mutation. Grasses that developed grain that then developed a mutation of the grain that allowed the kernels to stay on the stalk long enough to be harvested by humans. And the earliest forms of wheat, didn't hold on to the stem long enough to be harvested in bulk. But then with this mutation, and they stayed on the stalk long enough to survive the harvesting process, to stay attached during the harvesting process, then you've got to separate the kernels from the chaff, and the rise of civilization. But that rise of civilization also serves the plants, in that now this form of plant has a group of humans dedicated to spreading it, fertilizing it, caring for it, and continuing its propagation, because we have to save back some seed to plant the next season. And here is a plant that has ensured its survival by feeding people and creating itself in a way that encourages people to care for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an interesting thought process. Mm-hmm. Who's driving this boat?
Yeah.
Food for thought. Let's wrap up with a few final thoughts, and then let's talk about, you know, our standard end of the show stuff, and then gush about how much fun we're going to have at Ishtar Fest. So what are your final thoughts on tonight's topic?
Oh, my final thoughts are that this is a wide open topic for more research, and I'm sincerely hoping that they take a look more deeply into this. I've always had an affinity for trees. I've always thought that, you know, I've said this before on the air, as a kid growing up, the oak tree in front of my house, this great big old black oak tree, I would go out there and tell it all my problems. It was my best friend when I was a kid. That's not to say I didn't have actual human friends, but this tree was special for me. And I just can't explain it. I've always known there was a deep connection with trees. The Druids knew it. You know, the Vikings knew it. So it's just fascinating. So anybody who's interested, go out and look up Shall we give the name of the show? Should we plug them?
Sure.
Okay. The name of the show, we saw it on Netflix. It's a BBC show, and it was called How to Grow a Planet. Go out and watch it. Also, there's a book. There's a lot of research online about trees and giving off the chemicals. But there's a book that Raven Gramasi wrote that was all about this as well, the trees giving off the chemicals and how they communicate with each other through the fungus network that connects them all. Very fascinating. So we're finding out so much more and more about trees and how there's definitely, I think, some kind of intelligence at work there.
Well,
just,
you know,
I'm so fascinated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My final thoughts are that this definitely deserves more thought.
Uh-huh.
This is something that has, I wouldn't say it's rocked our worlds, but it has certainly altered our perception and is causing us to rethink that relationship between plant and animal. And it gives us a lot of room to think and ponder and perhaps meditate. Now, you were talking about that old oak tree in front of your grandmother's house. I had in Barbados, when I was down there for a few years, there was this great big baobab tree, which is a cousin of the banyan. And this great-grandfather of a baobab tree was my favorite place to go. I even moved a bench over under the tree and started tending to the tree, and it perked right up because it wanted companionship. Yeah. And I could feel the presence in that tree, and it was my comfortable place. And I truly, truly miss that tree in my travels. So there's certainly more to this than we have been taught in life. Mm-hmm. And now magic and science once more take a step toward each other. And the definition of magic that states that magic is simply science we cannot explain yet, is that definition is given a boost by this whole line of thinking. So take some time and think. Watch this series. Again, it was on Netflix, How to Grow a Planet. A geologist, a rock guy, coming to grips with the fact that plants really changed and created the face of the planet that we know today. Quite an epiphany. With that, my lady, my love, how do people get in touch with us?
Well, they can get in touch with us via email, and they can email us at littlestonebridge@gmail.com. They can also find us on Facebook, of course, and we have the Little Stone Bridge Pathworkings page. We also each have an individual personal page, and my page is Robin A. McKean, and Terry's page is Rev Terry Power HP. So those are great ways to get a hold of us. If you send us an email, put something in the subject that's going to catch our eye. We get hundreds and hundreds of emails, junk mail like everybody else, all day long. So unless you put something, important in the subject that will let us know that it's not junk mail, it may be overlooked. So just letting you know.
It may get lost in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I also want you to know that the Rev Terry Power HP is a public figure page on Facebook. There's also a regular friends page, Terry Power, And you can find that. Make sure you find, there's several guys that have the same name, lucky guys. But you got to find the one that says Spiritual Unity Radio Network. And that's the correct Terry Power. And so you can find that page on Facebook as well. Follow me on Twitter at RevTerryPowerHP. Let's see. At Ishtar Fest. Oh, what a blast we're going to have. I'm getting excited already. It's just about a week away. If you are in Central New Jersey and you have time on the weekend of the 10th or 9th and 10th, 11th, come to Ishtar Fest. www.handsofchange.org. Go there, find the link, click register, come on out. It's going to be a ton of fun. You heard us talking at the top of the hour. Robin and I will be participating in the main ritual. We're also going to be teaching a couple of workshops during the weekend. We're going to talk about creating a sacred, our own sacred temples. And when we say that, we're not talking about a physical building. We're talking about a safe place for open, honest communication. And how that open, honest communication can lead to greater depths and intimacies in any relationship. And intimacy not necessarily in the physical sense, but just a depth to any relationship that can come from open, honest communication.
Mm-hmm.
The other workshop we're going to be conducting is pretty much, it's probably going to end up being an open forum, but we're going to talk about getting involved in your community.
Mm-hmm.
How can we build community if we don't get out there and do something about it?
Exactly.
So we're going to have some tips and some thoughts and probably some conversation with the attendees and have a conversation about how to get involved in our community.
Right.
So, we're going to have fun. I mean, picture, this is going to be Sumer Fair instead of Renaissance Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of lords and ladies and knights and kings and queens, we're going to have Sumerian and Mesopotamian gods and goddesses and strolling minstrels that will be acting the parts of Sumerian gods and goddesses and heroes from the Fertile Crescent and those early religions. So, you know, it's interesting that we were talking about grain and early wheat giving rise to the first cities and agriculture. Well, that kind of happened right where these gods and goddesses come from.
That's very true.
So it's kind of an interesting tie-in to that very topic. So,
and people need to remember that back then that was called the Fertile Crescent because it was so green and fertile. It was not a desert as it is today.
Absolutely. Let's see. What else is going to be going on at Sumer Fair? Full moon ritual on Friday night, a feast, and main ritual on Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a butterfly release final ritual on Sunday.
On Sunday. Mm-hmm.
There's also going to be workshops, not just our two workshops, but there's going to be a beer-making, Mesopotamian kind of beer, old-fashioned, ancient-style beer, that very bready beer that was the precursor of all the beer we know today. There's going to be a whole workshop on how to make that with the tasting and everything. It's going to be a blast. There's going to be kids' activities so that the kids can go and do kids' stuff and be supervised while the parents and adults can go and attend workshops. Merchants Row. I don't know how many merchants are committed, but we're expecting Merchants Row. We're expecting other speakers. PA Night Owl, Jackie, is going to be doing a workshop. Elspeth is going to be doing story time with Elspeth for the kids and probably adults as well.
Yeah, and I just want to say one thing. Some of our elders are getting up there, and it's really hard for them to get out and teach. This could very likely be the last time that Jackie will teach out and about. You're going to have to know her and come to the mountain to hear her speak or listen to this radio show because she's on occasionally. So really would be wonderful for people to come out and see her because I can't stress enough how much she has taught me over the last 20 years. And the same thing goes for Lady Elspeth. Elspeth has been teaching for, you know, in and around pagan events for 20 years, but she's also one of our elders and getting up there, and she's slowing down and not teaching as much. So you're going to miss huge opportunity to see these two ladies in the same place in the same weekend that I don't think has happened in about 15 years. So come on down to Ishtar Fest and enjoy, have fun, but also take the time to get to know two of the most remarkable influences that have been in the pagan community on the East Coast of the United States for years. I've been to festivals, people stand in line to talk to these ladies. That's how amazing they are. So come on out. See us, learn, have fun, join our community, and just have a great time. And go to handsofchange.org to register today.
I also wanted to say that in the workshops, there's going to be a workshop on augury and ornithomancy.
Okay.
Basically, it's birds, you know, the actions of birds and reading the actions of birds for omens and messages. So you can see it's not going to be just, you know, just one kind of workshop. It's going to be a great deal of stuff. And so storytelling, Bardic circles, Sumerian races for the kids. Fantasy hair camp for the kids. It sounds like, you know. So, I mean, you get the idea. You just need to go to www.handsofchange.org and sign up and come out and hang out with us at Ishtar Fest and enjoy the adventure and the fun and the drumming and the feasting and the ritual and everything. So come on out and hang with us.
Yeah.
So I guess that's about it for tonight. We've had a lot of fun. We want to thank all of our listeners for taking time out of their life to share with us.
Mm-hmm.
We do love doing this, and nights like tonight are even more fun because we just get to, you know, go with whatever's on our mind. And we hope you enjoy it. And with that, I believe it is simply time to wish everyone a week filled with love and with wonder. Good night, everyone, and blessed be.
Blessed be.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.